Welcome to the Great Bays Tennis Podcast. I'm Steve Smith, episode 149. Let me push some numbers here and we'll get our guest on the telephone. We said that we're going to have David Anderson speak to us. He was on a few weeks ago, ringing once, ringing twice.
Hello.
David Dallas Anderson, how are you doing? Welcome to the Great Bays Tennis Podcast. Thanks for being on. You're our leader now by a margin, I think.
Well, thanks for having me again. It's always a pleasure to be on talking tennis. I'm doing well here. Hot in Dallas today.
We've had people ask us, as I mentioned the last time we were on, to circle back and talk about basics.
Yeah.
Let me just throw it out there and you can start. Let's talk about the volley. What comes to your mind in today's game, the volley?
Well, I mean, underused, underdeveloped, and I think that's why it's underused. You mentioned it before in the podcast. I think that it's a shame that every tennis lesson tends to begin with the forehand ground stroke. And, you know, I'm a firm believer learning this from you decades ago that, you know, the game really should be learned from the net backward. And I think that, you know, mastering the technique on the volley has become, it's really been put on the back burner. And then I think because of that, people don't get to the net. And as you know, volleying is instinctive as well. And I think that the amount of time that somebody has to be there in order to develop volley instinct in terms of movement and athletic bending, jumping, covering, reading, it's just becoming, it's hard to imagine actually from our end, looking through our eyes, how quickly it seems to be dissolving, disappearing right in front of our eyes.
The volley, underused, yeah. Underdeveloped, ditto on that.
Yeah.
Two-handed volley versus one-handed volley. What comes to your mind on that one, on the backhand side?
Well, yeah, on the two-handed volley on the backhand versus the one-hander, I think we get, we get a lot of looks, funny looks from people. The pathway to a great one-handed volley really is, the gateway is often with a two-handed volley, but, you know, a huge advantage to coming in with two hands is you can do it at a younger age and tend to have a little more of a support system in countering the pace of an incoming ball and just helping to get that feeling of getting the racket face square, flush. Somebody who you really remodeled their game, George Goldoff, was on the court today doing drills with some of the kids that I had on my court. And, you know, the difference in the sound when the volley came off George's racket. You can have somebody close their eyes and just listen to his volley when it's above net level. And, you know, his racket's just a wall. You know, you always say, take the wall to the ball. And, the two-handed volley, I think, you know, like you, I mean, as the player's learning to volley with two hands, we tend to have them go through the line, learn the one-hander as well at the time. But I think it just enables, especially younger kids, to go to the net a little more confidently and get the racket face pretty lined up, pretty square, and then get them in there more.
George Goldoff, we changed his name to George Silveroff, as you know. Just tease him a little bit, keep him in line. 7 years in Tibet, he was 7 months with us with COVID. Changing grips on volleys, what comes to your mind?
Well, I mean, again, I think the last time we spoke on this on air, talked about how, you know, I think so many questions can be answered by just that brief amount of time that the ball sits on the strings for any human being, whether it's you or I or Freddie Foreman. And the racket face needs to get right, needs to get towards the intended target. And there's grips that lead to that racket face getting square. and you know, it'll require some adjustment, but you know, it's really not debatable, is there time, because there is time to make adjustments to get to an efficient grip from the forehand volley to the backhand volley. It just has to be patterned in. And you know, I remember hearing from, I can't remember if it was you or Vic Braden, or maybe it was you quoting Vic Braden, but if on the way to tennis lessons in the back seat of the car, if a young player would just, you know, hold their racket out and just work on adjusting from an eastern forehand to an eastern backhand in the 30-minute drive they have from their house to the tennis courts for the lesson, and just do that on the way to the lesson, do it on the way back to the lesson, that, you know, they very quickly be able to acquire that skill to make the adjustment. And you know, and I think as the player goes on, I remember, you know, again, hearing around when I was around you and young, and hearing Dennis Vandermeer and talking about how when a player can really start to master spins on their serve and be able to hit slice and topspin, that they should be able to have less of a adjustment on their volley, and maybe you know, have somewhat of a composite grip, but still making a change. But developmentally, I don't think there's any debate on it that they should line it up on three and right side of one.
Yeah, Vic would say when he first introduced you, that was Vic, 5 minutes a day changing your grip. With Dennis Vandermeer did a great thing where it takes more time, and he would demonstrate changing from a forehand to a backhand, and with the grip change, without. And the point is, it take the same amount of time. But that's a very good point, yeah, that you share, is that Dennis would say once you can hit a spin serve, and you know, the strength, the skill, with the term composite, the term the old Australian was called Australian.
Yeah,
service line in almost a continental grip. I like the idea where you take the racket and like a chest pass. And so you can, not only do you have to change your grip, you got to turn your body and you got to straighten your arm really from a bent to a straighter position.
Yeah.
What about swing volleys? Do you think that one of the reasons that swing volleys is the reason that swing volleys are so prevalent, that one, people hit so many ground strokes, hit so many more ground strokes in comparison to volleys, or they're just locked into a extreme grip beyond an eastern, beyond the third panel? Why do you think we have so many swing volleys and so few conventional approach volleys?
You know, when I think of that word swing volley, you know, and again, I get these flashes in my head that, and I think of Timber Creek Racquet Club, and I was a tennis tech student or on the staff. I can't remember. It was the same role. Just one was paid oodles amount of money. And you had Lissa Kimmel on that first court, and you know, we were watching you give her a workout through there, and you know, she was a tiny girl, I remember, and even when she was 17, she was tiny, but you had her working swing volley primarily off the backhand, and it was really, you were having her drop back for what was a lob over her overhead, and just go up and hit top off of that. And you know, that stuck in my mind. I don't know when that was, mid-80s somewhere. And then shortly thereafter, people started kind of playing it more. I think that very few people want to get to the other side of that shot, meaning they don't want to see the actual volley. And it's much like when they play a ball in the mid-court, and they, you know, often try to paint lines or overhit in order to finish the point at that moment, because they don't want to actually see the volley in the next zone of the court. And so I think that, you know, there's a time and a place for it, for sure. I think it's very overutilized. I think that when you see, not just to avoid a volley, but I think you see so many players doing it to avoid overhead. And I think it's just, you know, I think it's actually it's a symptom, in my opinion, of just the lack of mid-court in development.
I love how you said that they're not looking for the other side of that. In other words, they're looking at that mid-court swing volley as a put-away shot, the point-ending shot, not setting up as a combination. Jack Grapple, yeah. The approach shot is the money shot. The volley is a cash in shot. Actually, for our listeners, Fred Foreman, we need to spend more time talking about Freddie. I'd like to introduce Dave Anderson as the second best tennis teacher in the history of North Dakota. That's not
maybe
fair.
Maybe third, Dave Gesser.
I met one of your friends who was working out at Indian Wells. He was from North Dakota. So maybe you're fourth.
Brian Peterson. I just texted with him a few months ago. Yeah.
Brian Peterson. But Freddie, fast Freddie. I just have some fun needling Anderson. He came down and he's younger than David. He was a wrestler. And I mean, he did look like, as you say, a world-class 4.5 player overnight. Fun guy. Yeah. But here's a story about a girl you just mentioned, Alyssa Kemmel. She went to Illinois, played. She was a captain of the team. I believe she was all Big Ten. And she never missed a practice. She was conditioned. But Carmen Clark, Laura Barrow, Julie Scott, and Alyssa Kemmel played against each other in the 5A Texas High School State Final back when everybody played. And they all four served and volley both balls.
Yeah.
That hasn't happened recently.
No. No, they were all homegrown and they ended up in dominating the women's doubles down there in Austin at the old Panic Allison.
And the same thing with approach shots. So we don't see too many conventional approach shots. You know, we call it a tabletop. You think going back, people might laugh, you know, it's, you know, it's 1974 when three of the Grand Slams were on grass. Jimmy Connors taking the approach shot, you know, played some side spin on the forehand side as he had a grip underneath three, had to pull the racket back in. And, you know, it came up with Stuart Van Horn being on. You know, it will be when you played Jack Kramer or when you played any of these guys, they all would say, when you hit short, just turn around and ask what the score is because they're coming in. But that tabletop approach out of linear pattern, volley added follow through. Any comment on that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, you know, the bubblegum reading that, you know, and I think Tennis Magazine has turned, you know, to a different corner here over the last few years. And but, you know, it. I remember, I don't know, a decade ago, and it said, is the underspin backhand dead? You know, you see all these things, right? And people that unfortunately believe them because it's there and it's written by a name person. And, you know, and it's funny to me that people will, you know, really work hard on the development of a underspin or what we call a tabletop, you know, more of a linear path with an underspin or a flat underspin, drive underspin. And they'll work on it, you know, in the mid court coming in off the backhand, but you know, the tennis ball doesn't know what side you're hitting, whether it's forehand or backhand. And the reason that it can be effective off the backhand is certainly applicable to the forehand side, but it's just, for some reason, people don't grasp that. And it, I mean, I think it's just a huge shot that interrelates to so many different things. And the approach shots coming in off the serve, you know, hurting the opponent on an inside out forehand and being able to just charge and come in and not give the person the time with a swing volley that you have to give in order to set up, hit it well, and just take it right out of the air. You know, that high tabletop volley. I've never really understood why people fight that, that shot, especially on the forehand, but, I can tell you that if I were a girl trying to play out on the tour right now, that shot would be high on my priority list of building.
Yeah, so many, you say so many things. I used to have a film of Prakash Armitage, fact checker. I believe he was USC. He played Davis Cup for India. I mean, obviously, his father, Vijay Armitage, what a class act. But Ryler DeHart, who you know you've played against in practice a couple of times, I had a film of Prakash Armitage. I believe it was Kalamazoo where he beat Ryler, but he played the tabletop approach shot. I've taught so many kids who don't play it. I mean, I think it's like, okay, you're just going to bolt. They're going to, you know, just blast the ball with,
They don't play for position.
Exactly. And then I think today, a lot of kids, they don't understand other sports if they play a little basketball, a little volleyball. Ted Schroeder, I taught tennis with his son, Rick. Some hotshot junior came on the tour, arching his back, doing the limbo, tosses the ball as a righty way behind his head. You know the story. So Schroeder comes up, gets down on one knee, hits an overhead off the return. He said, "Hey, kid, you can't toss that way up here." But I think that's with all our pillars, like a Jacobson, a green light point, you know, kids serving love 40, tossing way over their head. People think, I think in junior tennis, they think they have a pretty good serve because they do get trajectory by tossing way over their head. So the trajectory is what makes the ball bounce high. But when that ball bounces, it's right there with the paint. It's right there on the court. But they have to start young. You know, I've had a lot of fun with these kids come out with these dream grips and say, okay, other than the serve, you can't hit topspin on anything. And they're totally lost. You know, okay, just stay inside the baseline. And, you know, I like to just say, okay, a flat grip with, you mentioned term inside out, which technically comes from close to away, swinging away from your body. What are your thoughts on today's tennis? And I know from a tactical standpoint, it's not wrong, but you hear the commentators, the coaches, now the juniors, outside, of course, they run around the backhand, call that the inside out forehand, but then there's inside, inside, outside, inside. You think that is something that just has killed the technical term of inside out?
You mean swinging inside out, and has it been affected by the way that they use the verbiage?
Yeah, exactly.
In the commentary. I mean, you know, it's interesting. I know that, I don't know if it was Craig O'Shaughnessy's work or linked to data-driven sports, but, you know, they were talking about at the Aussie Open last year, 61% of the winners on the forehand came from the left side of the court, not the right side of the court. And, you know, you hear a lot of stuff about that. I feel like just like the swing volley, everything has a place and it just has to make sense. And, you know, for somebody to, you know, get a little bit weaker ball and make the move to the left slightly inside of the paint and to be able to dictate off the forehand like that. But when you see these people that are 6-8 feet behind the baseline and, you know, they don't have the speed to make it up that, you know, we see an Alcaraz maybe get away with. But it's just got to make sense. And, you know, the Paul Wardlaw's directionals, going back to that, I mean, are you running around to make an inside ball an outside ball and make it more difficult from a changing direction standpoint? I just think that, you know, everything is kind of tied together from my vantage point where, you know, every lesson in America seems to begin with the forehand and everybody associates weaponry with hitting this forehand. It can be a weapon, but, you know, so can the ability to be able to attack a short ball. I mean, so can a backhand volley. I mean, so I don't know if I answered that at all, but I just think that, you know, to me, when you think of that and you just think of what's going on now and you hear, you know, you see Isner hit 135 mile an hour serve and the return is that inside the service line of, yeah, I mean, there's going to be a lot of serve plus one type things on guys like that. And that he's going to go around and get his forehand because the ball's setting up and he has a higher strike zone and doesn't have to play it at his hips. And, you know, it'd be fun to commentate and take a live match and, you know, be able to slow it down like that and just kind of go point by point, you know, so people could see a lot of those things.
Yeah, you mentioned a couple of names where people can look on YouTube. Craig O'Shaughnessy, the brain game. He was in Dallas for a while. Didn't you guys play on the same softball team?
Yeah, good memory.
What was his batting average?
He was terrible.
Uh-oh.
O'Shaughnessy was a good athlete, though. Well, he was a good athlete. He was a lefty and clever.
Must have had good spirit. You got to give him a credit, though. You know, the Aussies, he probably didn't grow up playing a lot of softball.
No, he wasn't, you know, he just volunteered to be the catcher and, you know, in slow pitch softball, you let the ball bounce off the plate and throw it back to the pitcher. And he did have a great spirit about him. And, you know, I think like most Aussies, his favorite part was probably having a beer afterwards.
Load a high swallow through. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned Paul Wardlaw. I know he just recently got back into college coaching. He was the AD, athletic director at a boarding school. Say a few more things that come to your mind on the directionals.
That come to my mind?
Yeah.
I was actually talking about directionals with George Goldoff today, and you know, we're talking about particular players on the tour, and I think that you run, I think that you see some kids going to juniors collegiate tennis and they get away with it. They're redirecting tennis balls left, right, and center, and they just don't get punished, you know, and then they jump into, you know, when they don't get punished till it's too late. And, you know, I think that I, you know, I'm a huge Roger Federer fan, and, but, you know, you watch Novak and he's just surgical, in so many matches. And when he redirects, I mean, he tends to either be forcing play or he's just making a rally redirect where he's just rolling the ball inside the percentage post and saying, okay, let's try it the other way. And I think that, you know, when I go out and see tennis in junior tennis in you know, in a very good tennis state here in Texas, it, kids are just redirecting constantly with no rhyme or reason to it. And you know, it's the physics of it. I mean, you take an outside ball, you take a ball that comes across your body and you're 3-4 feet behind the baseline and you're hitting off one leg
and the contact points at shoulder level.
Yeah. And it's just, I mean, it doesn't add up. And, you know, it's tough. You know, I remember watching, tape Bjorn Borg back in the Tennis Tech days. And, you know, when they asked Borg a question about how or why, where he hits the ball. And I think his answer was, you know, I hit cross court and sometimes I'll go down the line.
Yeah.
And,
Vic Braden worked that for a long time. Richard Bodian, great technician who's up in Connecticut.
I spoke to him yesterday.
He sent me a copy of that. It's like, okay, blast from the past. You know, on directionals, yeah. Braden used to tell people chart the person who changes the direction is generally going to be the person who loses, but it obviously depends on where they're changing the direction of the ball from, the type of contact point, or they're inside the court, inside the baseline, inside the sideline. When you say redirect, why don't you touch upon that a little bit more? Is that a ball coming in cross court you take down the line, or is it a redirect? I mean, obviously it is by a common sense definition, or do you think of it just cross court to down the line, or is it down the line to cross court to redirect as well?
Yeah. I mean, when I was referring to it a moment ago, I was talking about people take cross court balls and redirect up the line. You know, I think that, conversely, when, you know, you watch a high level player and the player's left it hanging on the same side of the court that they've hit from, in other words, you know, left it on the opponent's inside ball. I mean, that ball's punished typically, and the rally changes and the control is given to the player who just got the inside ball. If they've done the right thing with the ball.
What are the first couple of thoughts
Go ahead.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, I was thinking of Dave Sievertson, you know, who you've met many times. And
great senior player.
Yeah, he's two-time world champ. And, you know, we worked out a lot for 4 years together. But he always used to say that he'd speak to the kids up and he'd say they're always trying to pull the trigger on the ball. That's really just the connector. You know, it's the connector to the net, to what could be a winning ball or a forcing shot. And they were one shot early. And that really is true. I think, you know, they jump the gun in terms of, and I think a lot of that's anxiety because I truly believe it goes back to the fact that nobody wants to be inside three quarters court inward to the net.
One of our guests, Andrew Rube from Harvard men's coach, I loved how he kept saying, it's how you frame it. And again, Severson, great guy, great player, that pulled the trigger versus connecting the different sections of the court, being able to get into the forecourt. What comes to your mind? Why do you think kids redirect so quickly?
I think it'd probably be different in many, you know, cases. I think that one thing that comes to mind, I think fitness is low. I mean, I think the sport's gotten soft. I think fitness is very low. I'm quite disturbed by the fact that you go to, significant tournaments and you play 10 point tiebreakers for the third, and then, you know, you go home and you have a personal trainer. And I mean, it just doesn't make sense to me. But I think that there's kids that, you know, as we have kids doing this program plus and running a mile just out, you know, in the downtime between, we know that, you know, they too much distance running can, you know, have an adverse effect, but these kids aren't even coming close to that. So in today's world and in junior tennis, and nobody's done enough track work to just build that type of aerobic base, I think, which is the foundation of fitness. And I think that's part of it. I think also that people are trying to skip steps. I think everybody's just trying to skip steps up this ladder of development. And, you know, they're putting a premium on power only and don't understand the relationship to high level play and how those guys, you know, are so capable of power, but they're building points. I mean, I feel like there's way less rallying if you go out and watch a 15K than if you watch world class play. The people are just banging. And, the amount of errors is just off the chart. And, so I think it's maybe a false perspective on what they really are chasing. Then I think also, and undoubtedly too, there's technical flaws. I mean, you know, the last thing I wanted to do through most of my life was hit forehands cross court and, deep anyways. Because I had a technical flaw that hindered me from really doing that. So I would redirect to try to change the rally into something else other than that.
Oh, it's great to hear that fitness. I do think, you know, the pull the trigger, the emphasis of power, of course the rackets have a lot to do with that. I think also too, you know, we have to praise tennis parents more, but I think also parents look at it and go, well, if they're over in that corner, why don't you hit to the opposite corner? Without even mentioning the parents, I think the young kids are going to think that, okay, they're over here and they see that open court. You mentioned the mile. Somebody that you and I both worked with, I would have loved, I know you too, would have loved to coach him in the very beginning. Father was a cross-country coach, made him run a mile a day. The guy could have 104-degree temperature and he was going to run a mile. What comes to your mind when you think of Scott Stewart?
Well, it's weird that, you know, because it's literally, I was talking to Scott about Scott Stewart to Mason Vaughn today. And, you know, I just told him, I said, Scott Stewart just ran. He just ran. I mean, he just dropped everything and he just ran. And he did his mile. He probably did more than a mile many times, but.
His father told him he's run a mile a day. Certainly he could do more, but I can remember just being around him because on an interim basis, you and I coached the team he was on. And he would say, okay, I got third shower. There's going to be three guys in a dorm room. They're going to shower. I got third shower. And he wouldn't claim first shower. So he wasn't thinking whether the water is still going to be hot, but he would go run a mile. Yeah. Just drop of a hat. I got to go run a mile. It takes nothing.
He was like clockwork. He didn't miss that for a long time. Even after college, he kept with it. And, you know,
he beat
Al Parker in Al Parker's last professional match before Al Parker packed it in.
I love how you mentioned names. Al Parker and Jack Winter. Jack Winter wrote for Sports Illustrated, and I got connected, and he ended up going to spend time with Braden, Vandermeer, and Van Horn. So I ended up being at Vandermeer's, and Dennis had these gadgets way back when that were like space age. Mm-hmm. So I was coaching, Jack Winter had earplugs on and I was coaching Jack Winter, and Dennis was coaching the great Georgian.
Parker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Al Parker. With you mentioned Mason. I mean, there's a young guy that you're coaching. We spent a lot of time with him. He came to us with his dad. I like his spirit, though. And, you know, I think that's important. You know, the expression, we'll get back to some tennis technique here, but miles on the legs. You can just tell if a kid has miles on their legs. Today I was in at Brandon's place, FM. There was the FM Performance Center, and he's got a modified court. We have some kids we're doing, working on technique, four of us, and he had three physical trainers and three physical therapists. So it's great to see people that are, you know, really conscious about working on fitness. Years ago, kids would just play all day, though. I mean, you just, you know, whether it's riding a bike or, you know, you run to the run to the courts. And I just got done with a long meeting, a girl that we've worked with through Miran Mann. She spent a lot of time with us. She's represented her country. She's going to Europe, and you get on that red dirt. You know, it's you got to have really, really strong legs. But on the, what do you tell your kids? But you know, we make them rattle it off with the reasons, the negative reasons for taking a down line across court. Why don't you give a few? I'll give a few.
Well, I mean, negatives for, let me just make sure I understood the question, Steve. So negatives about going down the line versus cross court?
You know, Anderson, we are going to send a copy of this to Fred Foreman. He's going to send you a grade. Freddie.
No, I just wanted to make sure I heard you correctly.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. Ball comes in cross court and they go down.
I'm not worried about it. If I had Freddie as a teacher growing up, I would have been at Harvard. If he would have been grading my paper.
The Harvard of party.
No, I mean, anytime you redirect on such a narrow surface, there's a high risk. And obviously you have less court to work with. I mean, the court's 4.5 feet longer, corner to corner on the cross. And, you know, the slightest hiccup when you take a cross court down the line or the slightest decel and the ball's gone. And, I mean, you're not going to make it. And, you know, the body's got to be more under control. Your swing path is less forgiven if you're not clean and you're not, you know, if your hitting zone isn't going north south, you know, during that critical 18 inches, you're going to miss a ton of balls. Obviously the net, you know, 4 inches higher, but to me, you know, I've always kind of on a personal level, you know, when you hear that on TV and, well, they went up the line and it was the higher part of the net. But the reality, I think when you watch a lot of world-class play and they are going up the line, they're going up the line to force play. And they actually often lower the trajectory of the shot a little bit compared to their cross court where they have to cover more court. And so the ball has a little bit more height over the net. And so I've never really, you know, I think it depends, you know, on that. But like, but I mean, and then you're potentially, if you haven't hurt somebody, you're feeding them an inside ball and giving them the opportunity to really take control of the rally if you didn't hurt them at all. But those are a few things that just pop into my head there. I hope Freddie gives me a good grade on that.
You know, you can flip it though. For example, our listeners, if you're playing somebody and they're not very fit and you want to break them down, you're going to, hey, I'm going to lose the first set, but I'm going to beat this person in three. I'm going to try at any opportunity to make them run.
Yeah.
You can also, you know, make it just a baseline contest by if you can successfully do that, because I just wrote down, yeah, as you said, 4.5 feet, less court, the net, which is insignificant in a lot of ways, especially if you're not using the net post, the net's higher to the outside. Braden, if you're off by 1 degree, you miss wide. You actually can make your opponent run, but they can make you run more. You lose steps. You have to actually, if you're going to be a baseline player, you go down the line and you're going to still stay in the rally. You actually have to recover to the other side of the court to bisect a potential angle.
Yeah.
With
well, I think what you said too, though, is, you know, some people have to make it a track meet to beat certain opponents, and being able to, I mean, if they put their homework in, done their homework with their skill sets, and they can redirect, and they understand concepts, tactical concepts, that the great base, and it's just common sense, really. I mean, give yourself margin on the sidelines, manage the risk, and I really, that's where I Djokovic, just watching him just redirecting rallies where he's just basically like a boxer saying, let's go 15 rounds and I'm going to take your legs out. And, you know, going back to Severson, one of the things he always told me, and when he'd be lecturing these kids, he'd look at him and he'd go up to a kid and he'd put his arm really at neck level. And then he'd put, both his arms really separating he goes, I'm either going to beat you from here, meaning he's going to beat you with mental skills and be better mentally than you and break you down mentally. Or I'm going to beat you. And he'd indicate kind of the torso of the body. And he said, or I'm going to pick on, you're going to have a weakness inside of your skills. And he goes, and I'm going to break that down. And he goes, but I'm certainly going to take your legs away from you. And he used to say, you may not be tired when we start, but you're going to be when we finish. And I mean, I watched him at 67 years old take the number two super champ kid, which is the top level of Texas play, kid going on to play Division I in 4 months. And he lost six in the third. And the other kid was doubled over, and it was, mid July. So I think that was a fun way for me to think about it, break down the legs, break down a technical aspect, or break down the head, and really go at a player that way, kind of like almost a boxer.
Yeah, with so many things. Coming back to what you said about Novik, I liked how Nick Baldieri used to say, rebuild the point. So you're in trouble. It's so easy to do today. If you're in trouble, you become the hittee versus the hitter, or the other person's really in charge of the rally. Today you just arc one ball back deep. You get to rebuild the point because they're not going to take the ball out of the air. Dave Severson, cool cat. I went to watch him here recently. He was in this part of the world representing the U.S. in the 70s. Actually, Raven Klassen's father was there as well. But I was at your place.
Raven's dad was a player?
Yeah. He was playing in he was representing South Africa. Good. So, Severson, I was at your place one time and I took a junior, and I was confident that I could have the junior beat Severson. And the junior, I believe he got up 5-love, and Severson still came back and won.
And I remember the exact court number two.
Yeah, don't say the junior's name. But
I'm not going to say the name.
But anyway, the way I talked to that kid, he probably has no one's probably spoke to him that way since. Although I know you every once in a while can blow up like a volcano, which is good.
Yeah. But I've gotten smarter. I choose my battles now.
Here's one from one of your old classmates, Tomas Olestad. You mentioned a top junior in Texas playing Severson. One thing you do on a clay court is you can say, okay, we're going to draw lines. You can on a hard court. You got to be careful when you put out those rubber teaching aids, flat yellow pieces, and you make the court. You just take a foot off each side. So instead of 27 feet wide, it's 25. And I remember Alex Vukovic, he was ranked as high as number two in the 18s. And I just told him, I said, you are going to lose today. Olestad came by and I said, yeah, you're going to play this guy. He's a little bit older than you, but he's going to beat you badly. But what we did is we made it more skill oriented because we made the court smaller.
Yeah, Olestad could go forward.
Yeah, it's just too bad he never conquered the serve. In our library, we have Vic Braden teaching him how to serve. I remember, we used to call it snow ski. You get the kids, it's 4.5 feet from the double sideline to the single sideline. And it's just a, be a human pogo stick, jumping side to side. And yeah, he did okay when the genetics were handed out. Back to some technical questions. With overheads, what's the first thing that comes to your mind with overheads? Technique, tactics?
I think the very first thing that comes to my mind is Chris Everett's dad. And again, I'm just going off the story from either you or somebody that I heard that how she had a definite flaw on her overhead, but the story of her dad Jimmy Everett feeding her grocery carts of overhead, despite the technical flaw. You know, she never really had a great overhead, but she gained some degree of competency. And I think that overhead, given the current state of the system of how kids play tennis inside of America and really just in tennis, when you don't come to the net in doubles, when you seldom come to the net in singles, you're not going to hit overhead. And, you know, I think that, I mean, it's a difficult ball to time. I mean, the ball's falling at the rate of gravity you know, it takes sound technique in order to be able to be effective at it with the racket and the body, and then learning the physical movements to be able to get back, the drop steps and crossovers. And, to me, I mean, it's just related to tactics. I mean, the technique is just like everything. It's completely related to tactics. And, you know, before I met you, I had a guy that I was very fortunate. He was a big Dennis Vandermeer guy. And luckily for me, he ended up in Minot, North Dakota. And he did teach me, you know, scratch the back and point. But, you know, I throw in football, throw in a baseball. So I kind of hit an overhead, much like the great base, even though I was a terrible student, luckily. And I didn't listen. But he just, you know, he used to call them stress busters because I had a horrible temper. And he said, just hit it. Just hit it. Hit it as hard as you can. Get up and hit it. But I hit a lot over it. And I don't think, I mean, it's actually mind blowing to think of how few net advances I saw 2 weeks ago at an L2 tournament. So I think number one, the technique on it is often taught a little poorly.
Now, somebody, two, I think, go ahead.
Yeah, the exposure to the net is just not going to, you know, give people, they need the exposure to get the immunity from the fear. Without the exposure, they're not going to, you know, they're always going to have the fear, and they won't gain the immunity to the fear.
With Crystal Schultz, I heard from him the other day. He's got one more Steve Smith, more than one Steve Smith in his directory. I get that. Some people send me a text and say, wrong Steve, sorry. But he was sent to us by Harvard to learn how to teach tennis, and then I sent him out to your place. But he was here first, and one of his assignments was filming 50 boys, 50 girls from behind, incognito on the forehand and on the serve. Very quickly, over 90% of the forehands were close to a Western grip, you know, and everything else to go with it, where the butt of the racket's almost hitting your earlobe. 90% of the serves had some version of palm up, but anyway, he had some help. It was run at a place, I think it was Michael Darcy, who was a tennis director, another tennis techer. He was running the Delray Beach Tennis Center, and we had quite a few people helping. It was just the tally system, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 12, mm-hmm. 12 and under nationals, 7 overheads were hitting 1,000 points. Very quickly, Malcolm Gladwell, Canadian author, best known for Outliers, but the movie Blinky, worked with Vic Braden, and he was amazed on a couple of things. That he found out that this YouTube clip was taken down. He said that he found out that the touring pros have no earthly idea how they hit a forehand. They can't articulate how they hit a forehand. I mean, mm-hmm. Jim Courier was proving that today, talking on TV, but with, the brain's got two sets of motor programming, one with stress and one without. And Malcolm Gladwell, knowing without knowing, so you certainly know this backwards and forwards, that a kid can hit an overhead out of a basket, but they can't hit an overhead in a match because they because they don't hit overheads in matches.
They never cross that bridge.
Yeah, we do.
They're stranded on one side of it.
We do a situational drill where you feed a high underspin lob, you have to let touch the net, then you go back, let the ball bounce, you hit an overhead, and you play the set that way, because kids just don't hit overheads. So what else would you consider a lost art? I mean, it's getting to the point where, okay, the one-handed backhand approach shot, serve and volley. I mean, what else do you consider lost art? What comes to your mind?
You know, I think it would depend on I mean, to me, it's more of a lost gem that we're watching again go away at a rate that's just disturbing, and it doubles. I think that I get a little bit concerned, to say the least, and kind of nauseated when I think about what's happened just over you know, what seems like a blink of an eye. I mean, it. You know, I remember being at the U.S. Open, and I was with my brother and a former junior doubles partner of mine, and we were watching Brandon Hawk. He was a Texas kid, and he won the zoo that year and got into the main draw with Nathan Overhauser. But right next door, the court right next door was another round of doubles, and it was Dave Roditi playing with Alberto Berrettini. And that was, I remember the first time that, you know, I had really seen that kind of caliber of play where the guy just had no intention of going forward, none, off his own serve. He wasn't even thinking. He was just serving and unloading on a forehand, and he, you know, kept the same grip for his backhand. And it seems like that seemed like just such a, you know, a different look. And now it's become the norm in just what seems like a blink of an eye. I mean, those guys, I don't know, they're probably 42 years old, maybe.
Berrettini, right?
Yeah, Berrettini.
Yeah, for our listeners, the Spanish player hit the ball on the same side of the racket. His grips were so extreme, but I mean, he cracked the top 10 in the world. Obviously, the clay court season brings some points up. I remember Alvaro Bentecor, who's been at Saddlebrook, Harry Hopman's forever. And I remember him telling me, this is going to affect tennis in such a negative way. And, you know, obviously a great character, great player, but people, it's like anything goes. It's like Jack Sock. You could learn to play tennis faster the way Jack Sock plays than the way Roger Federer plays. And if you ask Jack, confident guy, you know, he's going to go with his game. But you say, well, whose bank account would you go with? You're going to definitely go with Roger's bank account. I do think, coming back to the point you made on doubles, let's stay on that a little bit. I think parents should unite and boycott junior tennis. I told this to a parent. He goes, yeah, but there's too many wealthy parents that would, some of them would look at, well, if there's less kids in a tournament, my kid can win some tournaments. But parents boycotting junior tennis because the prices for doubles, it used to be a throw-in. Maybe it was $5 extra to cover a new can of balls. Yeah, if the kids were just to play one bounce doubles and everybody crashes the net, we like to do that. No poaching on the first ball. Everybody comes in. What do you do at your place to try to promote doubles?
Well, I mean, we play doubles.
That's a good answer.
And play it in, yeah, I mean, we play doubles and we play it. Well, you know, I heard you say this, I don't know, 4 or 5 months ago. Maybe it was just when we were speaking or, you know, it might not even have been in a podcast. I can't remember, but, you know, we're finding our kids are not, you know, equipped sometimes when they get paired with a partner that is from another area and that person doesn't come in at all. And the other people aren't coming in at all. And then our kids are kind of left hanging, and it's an odd feeling. You know, I'm playing this 5-0 USTA test and I'm out there, you know, with 18-year-olds you know, I can hit a pretty good block return and get the ball down at the feet, but it seems like every other person that I play, that you know, that used to be a great return. Volley went up and I was all over somebody's face. But now that ball's being clocked with a forehand. So it's an interesting adjustment. So, you know, we play doubles and I haven't really done it much, to be honest, and I need to probably where, you know, have one team just stay back off the serve and give our kids a little bit more exposure to that. So when they get in a tournament, they're more used to it. It's I don't know. I just kind of have this tennis purist mind in that regard. And it's just hard, but I probably could prepare them better. We could prepare them better for that.
No, but I agree. I don't do that enough either, because that's what they're going to face is have, have one team play one up, one back, or one team stay back and blast. And I always say the toughest thing about playing serve and volley doubles is to find a partner who serves in volleys.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's, I'm just watching the French. I mean, obviously you don't have to go to the French. You could go to any tournament and see it. I saw a little bit more of it this past, you know, a few weeks back in the young boys 14s. It was a little bit more of it. It was, you know, I think hopefully things circle back. Hopefully Alcaraz and the way he, you know, is not afraid to just attack and go forward. And, you know, young guys like Korda, who I think come in much more than he does. But hopefully they can, you know, make it circle back. I think Roger Federer's message, you know, when he basically told all the coaches and players, hey, people need to learn to volley. This has to change. And I think that could be played daily. That should be the USTA's mantra, you know, all over the nation.
No, going back to Jim Courier, obviously great respect for Jim Courier. I had a chance to, you know, meet his sister, coach his niece and nephew a little bit. I mean, you know, if someone like that became number one in the world, you watch him as a junior, you watch him as a player. I remember being at the Orange Bowl when he won it. And, you know, he did a lot of work with Jim Lehrer. Jim Lehrer was talking about Jim Courier before anyone really knew Jim, before he was on the pro scene. But today what he said about Alcaraz, he goes, he's just a natural. Well, maybe he's genetically gifted and this and that, but Braden used to always say, stop, don't say that. People don't naturally pick up the racket and play the way he plays.
Yeah.
And I think with Roger Federer, and if you, you know, Roger, I could quote Roger all day long. He was fortunate, or I was, as he says, I was fortunate to have the right coaches at the right time. I tell the listeners, you know, doubles. I mean, Federer and Wawrinka, they're not playing so much, but they sign up for the Olympics and they win the gold. What comes to your mind with the listeners? If you're a fan of Roger Federer, share that with us. What comes to your mind? Why you love Roger?
Well, I mean, yeah, my wife said I had a Roger fetish and
man crush.
But first of all, I think that whether it's tennis or any sport, to see anybody that has breathed that kind of rarefied air, that they're at a, you know, they're at that level where the elite athletes in other sports go to watch them, you know, whether it's Michael Jordan sitting in the stands or, you know, and they've just been at a level that very, very few people, ever achieved. Gretzky, people like, you know, Michael Jordan, Kobe, Jack Nicklaus, Tiger. I think that when people have been in that stratosphere and they've been able to navigate the whole scene, in such a classy manner and be such an ambassador to sport in general, let alone the sport they're in, I think it, to me, is something that, you know, I'm kind of drawn to. I think it's hard to even imagine, you know. And for that reason, that's a big part of it. And then the other thing is that the manner in which Federer plays and the very capable. I mean, I think he often gets overlooked and how good he was on clay, you know, and, I mean, he had unbelievable results on clay and he could just play on any surface. And he could play any style of play and he could adapt to any types of opponents, whether big servers or baseline, you know, counter punchers or whatever you threw at him. He had the ability to adapt because he had a skill set that was much more on a traditional sense. And Roger Federer, people I don't think connect the dots on what the finished product. And even though Roger Federer doesn't, maybe have the exact background inside of the great base, but the way he hits the ball really exemplifies very close to a finished product. And, I think he's a great model for everybody to try to go out and say, okay, yeah, I want to be able to do this, do that. And I think it's probably how he designed his game. I want to hit my, looking at the players of yesteryear and picking out the greatness of them and trying to mold himself after that. I also love how respectful he is of the sport. I mean, just the history of the sport. I just think that's such a cool attribute, I think, that he brings.
I'll come back to Roger. I was going to try to say something for every name. You mentioned all these people. Your wife, Jenna, I always say that she's the only person from North Dakota I know who's been to North Dakota. It's not really true. I've met a few hockey players that have gone up there to play at the university. But with Roger, he was here in South Florida for Formula One. Brandon Flanagan told the story. I'll just go through it very quickly. So that's at one of these clubs where, Brandon is connected. And so there's just two courts, I guess. And one of the courts, there's a member hitting balls. And then Kevin Anderson comes out and he's just easily hitting some serves. And the guy goes, "This is amazing. I'm getting to hit balls and watch Kevin Anderson." And the coach, the pro, goes, "Just wait 5 minutes. It's going to get better." So then Roger's agent, Tony Gotsick, his son comes out, Nico, who's an excellent tennis player, he's been played many times. He's on his way to Stanford. And and then the member goes, "Geez, this guy hits the ball better than Kevin Anderson." He goes, "This is unbelievable. I'm getting to hit balls and watch these two great players." And then he goes, "Just wait another 5 minutes. It's going to get better." And then Roger himself comes out. And then Flanagan tells him the story. And he goes, and then the guy, the pro, said, "Just wait another 5 minutes." And then too good to be true and wishful thinking is Arthur Ashe came out and hit some balls. But
wow.
Anyway, Arthur's no longer with us, so sadly. But Roger's hitting balls. I'm sure he's also helping. He's obviously been, can you imagine, young Gotsick is at a tournament and Roger Federer calls him up, asks him how he's doing. But just think about how much he watched Roger. But for me, with Roger, if you go back to the very beginning on how he was trained, and his mother, she started playing tennis late. I guess she got good enough in her 40s as a South African living in Switzerland. She played for Switzerland. And, the story goes, actually Chris Cleary, who wrote the book Master, and I think it's a great book, but I mean, I've read so much about Federer. I don't think there's that many new things that I read in that book. Now he's retired from the New York Times and he's going to write a book on Nadal. Great writer. But, I said to someone the other day, I think of Chrissy Everett. I was born the same year. That means that for 50 years, I've been reading and watching and just listening and getting all these tidbits on someone like a Chris Everett. But with Federer, his first coach, you'd think that people say, how was he taught in the beginning? But the mother said, "No, I was a volunteer." And in what she uses in this one biography, she says, "I was incompetent. I was just helping." And people heard it too many times for me. But he stood in one place on balance with long follow throughs. He was taught technique. Mm-hmm. Braden asked him, and Federer said he made a list. The list was, I've got to be able to hit all these shots. We go through basic shots and specialty shots and emergency shots. And even doing that, there's so many shots where you have to improvise with.
Well, don't you think that points to, the attitude of the household, one. Number two, the growth mindset of Federer versus the fixed mindset, which, can really, stop people dead in their tracks in pursuit of their goals.
Well, he's definitely worldly. His father, Robert, mother, South African, growing up in the Swiss-German part of Switzerland and then going to an academy where they speak French and just the level of exposure. But if you read about Roger, he went to some ITF tournaments as a junior and he got rounded. They perhaps didn't have consolation, but, lost the singles, lost the doubles. He's 5 years older than Nadal, and he just said there's no way I was that mature at 17. But coming back to the volley, You know, what does Roger Federer said about the volley? You know, go to the net, good things happen. He also says that people fear the low volley. He said about the Laver Cup, you know, we're doing this to honor Rod Laver, but there's other reasons. We got to teach the young guys to play. He's also said that the people's inability to come to the net, no net appearances is the reason that, and I feel bad about Andy Murray and his hip and injuries and such, because it was the big four for a long time, but the big three, Roger, I think it's because he won Wimbledon. He, you know, usually doesn't say anything wrong, but he did say, well, I drank too much last night and I mixed my drinks. And when he was interviewed, he said, the level of play is frighteningly low at Wimbledon. I know that less than 2% of the time when I'm returning serve that my opponent will come to the net. Now, granted, they've changed the grass, but it doesn't matter, even if it's on clay. I do think that, you know, the ATP players, especially the Americans, I think they're talking too much about fantasy football, having been around them. But, you know, also then depending on where they are on the food chain, as they're talking about the ATP pension. This is just on the men's side. And they don't really even look at charts. What else comes to your mind? I'll say, take a few more things on Roger and I'll name another stroke.
Well, I mean, you know, you mentioned Tony Kozik, who was really close with our former CEO, Eric Affeldt. I was fortunate, Eric and I became close friends over, I don't know how many years it's been now, decade and a half, maybe, or more. And had, through Eric, a couple, you know, unique chances to spend a few minutes with Roger Federer. And I think the fact that he's just so normal, he's just like, he was a very down to earth person. You could feel it. My wife jokes with me. She said, it's the only time she's ever seen me where I didn't really speak well. And, she said, you couldn't even speak. She said, you were just frantic. But I calmed down after a few minutes and got to kind of just appreciate the moment of getting to be around him and see the normalcy. And I think that, you know, that's an important point really, because, you know, I think you can be fanatical towards the pursuit of your goals, but I think that his balance as a human being is probably such a huge factor in his longevity. And I think that every junior kind of needs to, juniors and the parents need to kind of think about what that means to each household and make their household work, because, you know, you want to go the distance and you got to make sure the passion tank is filled up weekly in order to go the distance. I mentioned Wayne Bryan before when I was on here, and, you know, I heard him say to a group of parents at our club, he said, listen, it's no good if your son or daughter is top 10 in the section if you guys as a set of parents are ranked 240, and that's all got to be in balance.
Julian Krinsky, great guy, great speaker like yourself. He tells a story. He was on our podcast. I'm 99% sure I asked him. He was in a toy store in Manhattan, and he ran into the Fed and his wife. And Julian said, I have a one-handed backhand. He said he totally choked when he met the master.
Yeah. I mean, it was really just because of his normalcy. He's a bigger guy than I mean, standing next to him. I'm not a small guy, but I look like Freddie Foreman standing next to him.
With the Fed, I one time was in a room, it was just the Fed and myself, and I just said hello to him out of Indian Wells. I just think, okay, this guy, he needs a break. Everybody's just hassling him. And then many times when I was working for this magazine as a writer, I'd be up at the US Open, and, you know, he generally is playing a night match, and it takes a long time for him to come in because, one, he wins. Two, he's got to go in and get a massage and stretch and eat. And his father would always come. And he would, it was, That was, I think, the French first. You answer questions first in French, then in German. But he doesn't speak German as well as he speaks the other three. But he was just like, he was going to be professional. I'm sure his father was critiquing him afterwards. But I always wanted to raise my hand and say, because everybody's asking about the match. And, you know, I kicked myself. I should have asked him about, you know, when he was a kid doing this and doing that. And I mean, that's where I think they should go into more details on how he learned. And, I've read that, you know, you show him something once and he could just, you know, try it a couple of times and he would have it. But here's a Federer story. We'll come back to hitting balls. But so I'm at the US Open and my poor self telephone skills, I'm working my phone. And it was like I was in the Beatles. I look up and all these people are just running towards me. And the crowd gets bigger and bigger. And I'm just standing there. I'm looking up. I'm going, what is going on? And I was right by the Mercedes window where they have cars on the grounds at Flushing Meadows. And I look over my shoulder. It was Roger Federer in the window waving. And all these people were just running to the window to get their photo taken with him. But, yeah, pretty huge. I know when he was at the Olympics, every other player, they had a tent for 400 media, and for him, they had 4,000. But as far as hitting the ball, I mean, Sampras comes to my mind too. Is that, do you think that many juniors copied the Fed?
Not really. I think before when Pete won his last one and, you know, kind of said goodbye to the sport, and Andre, you know, lasted a little bit longer. And you would think those two guys would have had just a huge impact on American tennis, certainly in terms of how we were teaching kids and how kids were, you know, trying to emulate their heroes. And I mean, they had seemingly little or no impact on, I think things got worse really quick after that. Then Fed came around, you know, and made his stand. Again, I think it didn't really have an impact. I think that there was a lot of confusion maybe on Federer with, you know, he's so relaxed and so far out to the right when he hits his forehand and so relaxed right after the hit. And I think that a lot of people misinterpreted what made him great on his forehand side. And they didn't understand, I think, also. I mean, Fed's forehand could have been better. He often collapsed a little early. And I mean, when he went off on that side, you know, he was kicking 35 errors on there. And, so I don't think that it impacted like we would have hoped, you know, and I hope Alcaraz and you know, watching Sebastian Corda, you know, hit off the ground and, you know, there's some good models out there for people to try to follow. Some of the things Rybakina does on the women's side.
Yeah, she's great.
You never know what's going to grab the attention of the people. And yeah, when I was out in with Coach Dom, one of our coaches here, young British coach, and we went out to San Jose to the Mubadala last summer. You know, Badoza was one or two in the world at this time, and that tournament was in mid or late July, I guess. And Wimbledon had just finished, and Rybakina is a Wimbledon champ. And you know, we got there 5 days early, and Rybakina was on her own. She was navigating the entire tournament on her own. She was just sitting in a corner reading. She was such a interesting person just to observe because. She was comfortable being quiet. You could tell she was comfortable in silence. And it wasn't until the day before the first round that, I guess what you would deem her team, a coach and a physio, it looked like, showed up. She was just, arranging hits with anybody that she could find there. And, you know, I just through a little research, and I know you've actually spoke about it on the podcast before about how, you know, she didn't have a private lesson. I mean, she was in a group of six till I think 16, and then she got moved to a group of four. And then she didn't really have one-on-one training till after 18. if I remember it correctly, but it was something very close to that.
No, from a very early age, she did 2 hours of tennis and 3 hours of fitness. And one of the reasons is, you know, money, lack of indoor court time. But, you know, that's, you know, the American juniors are, you know, they need to be reminded that they need to do more physically. And, you know, granted, when we, you know, you and I last time we spoke, we talked about the USTA, but people have to realize that we go way back. We're not talking about the current, just the current staff members. It's the same thing with commentators. It's going to go over time. Coming back to Roger, you know, 2-1-2, and he warms up on the forehand. That's what people should look at. You know, it's like if you were to study a player, if you could study them at the same age, you know, if you're 14, how do they play when they're 14? I think that too many times, especially YouTube and such, that junior players are looking at the pros. You know, for me, when I was a kid, Bob Uhr, a great hockey player, he could do whatever he wanted. You know, there, I go, Serge Savard said there's three types of hockey players: stars, superstars, and Bobby Orr. And you would never take the puck. You're trying to get out of your zone, and there's four checkers. You would never take the puck in front of your goalie. It was just like, no, you don't do that. And it's kind of like in doubles. No, you don't serve and stay back. You go to the net. There's just principles. You know, I always say if there's 100,000 people in a stadium, a football stadium here in America, and the running back goes up the middle hanging on to the ball with one hand instead of the breadbasket with two, everybody in the stadium knows. But for some reason, you know, like I knew, okay, you're playing shortstop in this pickup baseball game. You got to get your body in front of it. You just, there's certain principles in all these sports. I am the world's worst basketball player, but I was called in some game sometime where there's a little money on the line. Who's going to pay for dinner and such? And I just, okay, I am not going to shoot. I'm going to stay between the person I'm guarding the basket, and I'm just going to be Charlie Hustle. And I had enough background in other sports. Plus I knew that.
Well, you played basketball down there at Patchery Park with us that one time.
Yeah, I'm sure I was the worst one there. Basketball, I told a couple of kids we sent to park today, drop hit tennis balls, you know, just too wet to play some basketball. And, you know, the Stevie Nash played 30 minutes of basketball without the ball. And I said, just take tennis balls and drop them to the basketball hoop and just watch how simple your forehand and backhands become, because it's the same thing. I throw this out at you. It's a Dennis Vandermeer line: interrelationship of strokes, interrelationship of spins. I mean, you can relate that to Roger, but what comes to your mind when you hear that statement? Interrelationship of strokes, interrelationship of spins.
I think, you know, I've got this coach here, been with me almost 2 years now, and he's been just a tremendous addition to our staff, Hernan Caller. And he's an Argentinian from Buenos Aires, and, you know, he's in his 40s. Been in tennis his whole life. And, you know, he came aboard, he's just every minute he has, he comes to court 13 and just observes, talks tennis. And, but he said something to answer your question yesterday. He goes, everything just starts with the ready position, doesn't it? And he goes, the more I'm around it, he goes, it just seems like everything starts with a ready position and being organized. And I think that when I hear interrelationship of strokes, interrelationship of spin, you know, getting people to just have a great ready position and then just learning to coil their body. Obviously, you can have grip adjustments on the forehand, you know, for the groundy and such, but developmentally, I think it's just, there's just such a huge advantage to just plant the person's forehand grip on a true Eastern forehand, which, you know, I'm not sure if the world of tennis teaching agrees on what a true Eastern forehand is, but we should all be in agreement on it. And, you know, that from there, a player can just play every zone of the court. I mean, they can play a volley back up 10 feet and play a drive approach shot with underspin. They can play an approach shot with topspin, and they can go back to the baseline and make circular swings and rip top like Sampras and Steffi Graf. Federer wasn't far from it. So yeah. I think that.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, no, I mean, it. You know, I just think of organization and, you know, the organizing their system. And you know, I do believe that when people have radical grip adjustments from, you know, way under on the forehand to, you know, extreme left-handed grip on a two-handed backhand, if they're a righty, their non-dominant hand being extreme and the impact that it has, I don't, they're just, there's no way they can have that in a relationship. So the foundation work from the ready position on, I mean, basically we, as a culture of tennis teachers and coaches, I mean, we should, you know, you talk about it many times, and we should just say, okay, for the next week, all around America, we just have our kids simply get in a mirror and just try to emulate Djokovic in the ready position to return serve. And everybody get exactly where he is with his hands, his elbows, his body, his posture, his eyes, looking like he's a shark hunting, you know, at a shipwreck. And just get everybody to get that look all week.
Yeah, you mentioned organize. That was Dennis Vandermeer used to say, instead of split step, you'd say organize, organize, organize. And you got to organize your feet and organize your hands. One thing on the serve's the only shot that you're not in the ready position. But with a serve, for best results, you want to just leave your hands alone initially. Just leave your hands alone, just like on a volley, just like a unit turn. Leave your hands alone and initially just turn. I know Dave Secker is always saying that. He's the coach at NC State, associate head coach. He's over in France now with Blair. And yeah, we get him on the podcast and say, okay, how many centered ready positions do you have? You know, do people even notice? I mean, it looks like Djokovic, that's the most important thing to him at the moment, is how has he centered that racket on the return to serve?
Yeah, it's impressive. You know, I feel like at the tail end of Serena's career, and I haven't gone back and done the research on it, but I feel like somewhere in the last year and a half of her career, she made a more conscious effort to try to almost acquire that exact look. Thinking back to where I used to see her and then looking at her at a particular point, it looked like there was somebody in her camp was basically saying, hey, let's get that look. Again, I may be wrong, but I'm just going off my eyesight and my history and my brain.
Jimmy Connors, and I think it's unfortunate that people say, oh, you're mentioning some of these players. I've never even heard of them. A lot of young kids today, you have to be reminded about Agassi's success. But with Connors, he had the grip close to four. You know, for our listeners, counting the bevels to the right, because Jimmy was a lefty, but so you, whatever direction you're going in, is he had the racket centered, even though he had the grip close to four. So I'm always telling
players. I remember you working with Ryler on that in Tampa. You were telling him, you know, cause he had his grip under a little, and, he said, hey, you can still square up and play a block on the return, even if you're three and a half or.
Yeah. When people hear us talk about grips, I mean, they think, oh, they never let anybody volley with a continental grip. I love how Braden used to say, I don't care if you shoot the ball out of your armpit, you can have the racket any way you want. But you just have to think about no such thing as a perfect grip, just a grip with the least amount of adjustment. Mackenzie McDonald on the forehand side. That's a little calculation that he has to make, and he has great technique overall. Not his serve could be better, obviously, but big time mover. But yeah, people that have come to us and their grip is closer to five. Okay, if it's not so far over, it's on four. I always tell people, I communicate with Austin Krajicek's father today. Both Austin and Rob know those two with Sherry a long, long time. And with Austin, I remember he went to Balotelli's early. It's kind of like he went to the jungle. Perhaps he went a little bit too early, but you know, he's three or four in the world. He's way up there anyway. So you don't have to have such and such grip, but keep in mind, we're just telling people, okay, here's the best math. This is what's most efficient, least amount of moving parts, least amount of muscle recruitment. So I don't think, you know, people should put words in someone's mouth. Oh, they're telling everybody to do it this way.
And I think that The last time we spoke, Steve and I talked about how people, haven't seen, for instance, you in action sometimes where, you might inherit a player. If somebody comes into you for rehab, complete rehab, you may approach it just, it's very matter of fact, right? It's the same thing if they came to me for just complete rehab. But if you see somebody, we might make suggestions, but I think that it's part of the art and the beauty of the tennis teaching of what people would think of in the Great Base that are maybe shooting holes in it, that are taking shots at it, is the ability to, still mold somebody's game, even if they say, okay, no, I'm sticking on this grip, and to make it, okay, we'll make it the most efficient version of that. Because, there's a lot of people that can't see down the road. And no matter how much you tell them, they're not going to do it. You can just smell it. And so you have to, you're almost forced. It's like I kind of use the analogy. I mean, when you go to the dentist and you need a crown, I mean, you want the cheap one, or you want the porcelain crown, or, and you can get your tooth crowned, but, one of them's going to look better and one of them's going to last longer and less chance for problems down the road. And basically the Great Base, we try to give people a porcelain crown, the best finish to their game. And, it's a shame when people don't see that as a consumer. And it's a shame that many people in the industry can't see that. That's really all it is.
No, that's a good, very good analogy. Brian Teacher, Australian Open champion, mm-hmm. Great player back in the day. And it may have been one private lesson, but he worked with Vic Braden. Actually, in the 60s, all sorts of people worked with Vic Braden. And really phenomenal how many ranked players out of Southern Cal worked with Vic. And, he got into research, and back in the day, there was no summer camp. There was just summer camps. There was no homeschooling. There's no academies. And Vic really got into the adult business because he wanted to raise money for tennis research. But Brian Teacher had a beautiful backhand, but he didn't want to change his grip on the forehand side. And Vic said, you got to sign a contract. Where he was not responsible. So, who knows? I don't know if he was 13 years old or whatever. He said, hey, just write your name right on this napkin. I'm not responsible for your forehand. But, Laver, not a true continental, but pretty close. I mean, people give him credit for, revolutionizing the game with topspin. On this side of it, Jimmy Arias gets all sorts of credit with what he does on the forehand, what he did on the forehand. But if you go way back to Bill Tilden and Bill Johnson, Little Bill, he had an extreme grip, and it's like there's nothing new under the sun. With somebody's playing one-handed, two-handed, somebody comes to you, they want to be a one-hander. What are your thoughts
on the backhand or developing
groundy? Not the volley, the groundy.
I think that, like, for kids in our program, we try to just like. You, I mean, we try to get kids to be able to do both. I think there's advantages and disadvantages on both ends. But from a developmental standpoint, I mean, we have our two-handed players. I mean, they can be fed a ball and hit a pretty good one-handed backhand, and it only helps the cause for their two-hander. But the contact point's so much further in front on the one-y. I was a two-hander, not that my game should be modeled after by anybody, but, I remember being a two-hander till I was 13 and a half. And then I saw Jose Luis Clerc, on TV, and I thought, he's that guy. I didn't like his hair, but I loved his backhand. And, so I switched, and Victor Pecci came along, and that sealed the deal. And I think that it seems that so many players with one hand, especially from a particular era, not so much anymore, were just looking to go forward more. But now you look at, players like Musetti and many others that have one-handers, and it doesn't necessarily seem like it's the case.
We'll have to have our listeners look it up. Freddie Foreman and Victor Petchy, they look alike, baby. Victor was the guy who had the earring before anybody had the earring. Cool guy.
Yeah.
With earring. Yeah, he's just movie star good looks. But the 70s, really, you know, Connors came along, born in what, 52, Everett 54, I think Borg 56, like boom, boom, boom. But there was always two-handed players. But now it's just flipped. I mean, the one-hander. But I do think that the two-hander should be able to play the one-handed backhand approach. They should be able to play a one-handed backhand lob. They should be able to teach one-handed backhand. They should be able to demonstrate all the shots with their opposite hand.
Yeah, for sure.
I do think that the plus-minus, if you put the serve first, return to serve second, you know, but if you can play a one-handed backhand, you just, if you stay with it, like Justine Henin from the beginning said, well, I just lost a lot. But you can't be wishy-washy about anything. Either you're in or you're out. We always tell people either you're a one or a two. And if you're going to go for a one-hander, you got to give it some time. Yeah, I think it's crazy. I mean, we've coached so many kids. They come to, they have a one-handed backhand. They run around their backhand and they hit a forehand. And if they don't hit a forehand, they hit a slice backhand with an inefficient grip. You said, well, you said you wanted to be a one-hander. You only learn by making mistakes.
And you got to swing.
I don't think, coming back to the Federer point you made on the forehand, where, I mean, people think it's all on the wrist, and they're just, if they could see high-speed film, it'd be like, no, you're wrong to say it's all on the wrist.
But yeah, I think it captures, I think with Fed too, I think it's never better to, I love watching Federer in the ad court, you know, on a return of serve. Somebody serves, you know, into the ad court to his forehand. And I think that, you know, his path when he goes inside out, I mean, it's like, it, to me, it's one of the cleanest times that he shows on his forehand side. It just tracks. I mean, and his palm's just right behind the racket, and his hand just tracks out towards the, you know, target area.
But one thing, when he misses big.
He does miss big.
You know, he's not, you know, I like the comment, you know, if you hit the ball in the net, you got to put your tail between your legs and walk up and get the ball. I mean, if you hit the bottom of the fence, you miss by the baseline by 21 feet. If you hit the net, you're missing the baseline by 39 feet.
He pulls the trigger. Most of the great ones do, it seems.
Yeah, and you have a better chance of having the racket face be vertical to hit if you swing fast and if you swing slow. Jim Lehrer, for people listening and try to put all these things together, coming back to Braden, you have a better chance of making the shot if you swing fast and you swing slow. But I like how Lehrer said you're better off to be the one ball blast than the forever push.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, the anxiety that people feel when they play tennis in the ladder of that, where they're just, you know, basically hoping for an error from the opponent. It's almost like playing basketball, you know, on a team and just not wanting the ball, you know, not wanting the ball to come into your area. That's a terrible feeling. You just got to want the ball. You want to get in the action. You got to just swing. That's what, you know, it's funny because somebody asked about Alcaraz. They said, how do you think he grew up? And I said, to me, he was given the freedom to fail. I mean, I don't think, that's what it looks like to me. I mean, he was just given the freedom to fail in the sense of, you know, very process oriented, and just the guy just, he was rewarded almost for doing the right things, it seems, over and over, and just swing.
Well,
he's got the racket right, does so many things technically and you know, go forward. And where I think kids are paralyzed these days, because it's just, everybody just can't get past the moment they're in.
And that's why
we see such a mess out there.
When you ID a player, are they all court player, baseliner, you know, counterattacker? Yeah, you just hear different things. With Korda, I was told, you know, he grew up at Ball Terry's. He played several sports. Actually, there's a hockey rink not too far from IMG. He played hockey. But when he was in his early teens, his parents, who both know the sport so well, they just had to play against girls. You know, the teenage boy, the most unmanageable animal of them all. It was perhaps before he was a boy, but I just heard that. It's just like, that's pretty clever. Here would be something that, you know, the all-court player, the player is looking to attack. Like, say that would be your game, being an all-court player, looking to go forward. I'd say, I'm just going to beat this guy staying back. You always tell people, you should be able to beat somebody three ways. I'll beat you with defense. I'll beat you with offense. I'll beat you with a combination of both. But I think there's, you know, that's one sad thing, and you have to, you know, I just cringe for kids today that they play, you know, local tournaments. I mean, everything goes on a computer printout. You know, it's not, you know, that the 10-point tiebreaker, you used to play someone and say, wow, I know I got this. I'd like to play on the court a little bit longer. You know, have this help me for the second round match. And, you know, again, you'd have to just clearly know that you were going to be a shoe-in to win the second and third set, but you could experiment in the first set. I don't think any of that's gone away. I mean, it's just such a crisis that kids don't even venture. They're really playing the same way. 10s, 12s, 14s, they're just bigger and stronger by the time you start blasting balls in the 18s.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. They're just carbon copies of the game that they came into the sport with a little bit more physical maturity. Kind of sad.
With the forehand, it seems like today the arguments, we try to stay away from arguments because if you know, I was tongue-tied the last time I tried to say it. The dimensions of the court and physical laws dictate stroke production. No coach's opinion or any unique theory. In the 11th hour, the last time I talked to you, but
yeah,
with... comment a little bit on where you see the game headed. You know, you talk a little bit about injuries. I mean, you know, kids are just looking at forehands. They only play tennis, the wear and tear, and just playing on hard court. So what comes to your mind when you think of injuries?
I spoke about that when we had the privilege of having Vic Braden come and do a clinic. I mean, it's going back probably 26, 27 years ago into the 90s somewhere when we held the Rolex and he had about 50 kids out there on court number 6. And Billy Frere's son, Jimmy Frere, hit the ball really well, technically. He was a young boy, about 10, and Vic had him out. And Vic was talking about Gustavo Kuerten, Guga. And he was almost prophetic in talking about him. And, you know, he mentioned that the way he hits a ball, you know, he runs the risk of shortening his career because of, you know, he compensated well. And he was such a long, wiry athlete, Guga was. You know, but it was interesting how that came true in terms of Guga's career. And I think there's a lot of kids that... you know, they're never really using the ground. They're never using the physics of it, the ground reaction force to generate what they need to generate. And you're putting a lot of strain on bodies that are not physically developed and, you know, compounded by grips being extreme on the forehand and, you know, kids with string technology. And then I think that the average hard court over the past, you know, 30, 40 years has really slowed down. I hit balls a few years back at Indian Wells when I was there. You know, the court was so slow, it was unbelievable. And I could barely make contact, it seemed. And that was the year, by the way, that I'd never seen really the game played like that, where Federer just, I think it was 2017, where Federer just routed Rafa. And I was watching the ease with which Federer was taking Rafa's ball, you know, as it was climbing up off the court. And it was just, it was mind blowing to me how the guy was doing that. And I think that many of these kids, you know, I think it's always interesting me how much knowledge we've gained as a community in tennis on sports science in terms of, you know, how to prevent injury, how to get fit, nutrition, and et cetera, et cetera. But I think injury rate has grown exponentially. And, you know, so yeah, I don't know the exact reasons why, but I do believe that, you know, some cases may be overtraining, maybe, but I think it's more about inefficiencies. And I think that the biggest inefficiencies tend to come on in my viewing of where people are hitting balls. They're hitting a lot of forehands, and they're hitting a lot of forehands poorly. You know, in the point, they're trying to get all forehands, and they have bad technique on them. And they're just setting themselves up for an injury to happen. And then secondary is the serve. I think the serve is just, you know, it's just a matter of time till many people's bodies collapse from a body part breaking down with some of the mechanical aspects that you see out there on serves.
With going back to Guga, for the listeners, maybe the coolest guy ever in tennis, Ricardo Acioli, like Guga, a Brazilian, he was on our podcast a couple of weeks back, coached him in Davis Cup. But the image of Guga, he's a righty, and he's on that right foot. He's just swiveling. He's just always on the right foot. And that's just the wear and tear. I've heard Tom Gullickson say recently that they should do some homework on kids playing other sports and not, you know, the overtraining. They're certainly overloading if they just hit one shot. I mean, they're only hitting a serve and a forehand. And there's some people that's all they have. You know, there was a funny line when Agassi had his the haircut where it was a mullet, party, a business up front, party in the back. Mm-hmm. And Ivan Lendl said he's a forehand and a haircut. But that wasn't really fair to Agassi because, I mean, he did so well by working his feet and how he played with his lower body. He wasn't the best mover, but what a great ball striker.
Yeah. I always find myself going back to YouTube and watching Federer and Agassi at the Open.
That's something we
just
touched
to watch the ball striking.
We touched upon that so many times in these podcasts. Hopefully they're helping out where, to go back and then the kids, you know, what are they looking for? You know, Andy Fitzell, with all his time with Vic, I think I'm going to guess 10 years consecutively they were at Indian Wells. And Andy and Vic would film from the ground up. That was the footage. The players, I mean, they lift. They're using their body, and they get so far below the ball. And you have to be really loose in the shoulder. But let me have you comment on this. What are your thoughts when you hear loosen the shoulder, but you got to be loose in your mind to be loose in your shoulder? I mean, if you're tight, you're tight. Tight mentally, you're tight physically.
No, I mean, 100%. I mean, and you know, thinking of Guga, watching Monfils last night, I think it was, wasn't it? The nights kind of run into each other, but watching Monfils play against Baez, just looking at the joy he had out there competing, and when he was starting to cramp up and he hiked his shorts up and he started to, you know, do his little dance with his legs to try to shake his cramps out, making these faces. And you know, it's always drove me crazy watching him over his lifetime because, I mean, if the guy could have just gone in and he who knows what else he could have done in the sport, because he's a physical specimen. But yesterday, the same thing. I mean, he just had so many balls that he could have just gone forward on. But I think his mental disposition, how loose he is and his just relaxed nature. I mean, you say it all the time. I mean, relaxation and calmness are huge. And, you know, I've got some kids that certainly are just really, really clean. They've been in it long enough to where they should be on automatic pilot, but in terms of just run and hit, but their mind isn't allowing them to do it. And it's not because they're overthinking on their technique. It's just their, you know, the way they're wired in particular on their brain type. And then, you know, I think that going back to that growth and fixed mindset, I mean, it's just, you know, it's a tennis match, you know, and it's just a ball and it's just one point, and people have to learn to just free up. I mean, that was hard for me to do. I know it personally, but, and more so in tennis than any other sport. Never really felt it in any other sport with the support system of team stuff. But tennis, I really felt it. But once you feel it, it's like, oh, wow. I mean, it's like biting into filet mignon versus a, you know, a cheap steak. And you kind of, once you taste it, I think you never want to go back. And I think, you know, for everybody, the maturation is different. But I still think the attitude of the household in many cases, I mean, for me, it was all self-induced because my parents, honest to God, they don't know how to keep score in tennis. And they never did know how. They couldn't tell you what any scoring aspect of tennis was. But so they had nothing to do with that. It was all me. But I think in many of these kids' cases, I just think it people have to be really careful how they communicate to their children post-loss. You know, separate feelings, make it fact-based if they're doing charting, whatever. You know, again, I think back to that clinic that Wayne Bryan did, and he said, and you've heard him say this in clinics, and when Bob and Mike lost, he said, what do you want to eat and what do you want to drink? And, you know, he only really spoke to him from a critical standpoint after wins when their veins were open. So I think everybody's different. I think everybody's a little different in that regard. And I think that's kind of the fun of coaching is figuring out, you know, what buttons we can push on each person and to get the most out of them.
Yeah. You know, certainly we have two thoughts on parents. I should be able to rattle off the name. I mention this all the time. It was a woman with USPTA. She wrote a great article, Conscientious Neglect. The parents should have conscientious neglect. But at the same time, we tell parents too, if you use the content that we put together, you can be proactive and it's just, you know, it makes sense financially. Okay, you can get out there and toss balls to your kid. You can, you know, it can be done. The parent child can be done. But now your parents not knowing how to keep score. You know, in ice hockey, you know, you get to a certain point where you're on a bus, but when you're a little kid, the parents are carpooling and taking you. But I can remember, and it was insignificant. I was ranked top 10 in prep school cross country, but the public schools were not in that ranking. And, you know, all you had to do is have, you know, one good time. And there's a story behind the one good time is that the people running number one and number two weren't there. And the coach didn't tell me how good the number one runner was on the other team. So I had this really, really, really solid time. And then, you know, I always tell the kids, yeah, I was gutless because I just kind of told myself, okay, I'm respected. I'm ranking and running on the varsity and I'm ranked and da, 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 where I wasn't just leaving it on the line to get in shape for hockey. Cause I mean, guys were going delirious. Guys were spitting up blood. Yeah. But my parents came in and they got a little bit lost. There was no GPS. And my mother showed up with my father and I was already done. And the kids just kept coming in. It was one of those races where it's like a rainbow of colors. And there was like 400 kids running. And she goes, oh, they staggered like cross country. And the point being with her question, she had never been to a cross country match at cross country meet. I would say this to come back to Monfils, you know, the conditions at the French when they're playing under the lights, a little heavier, different animal. But I think that he's, you know, I just say think. I'm not going to say I know. We have to go back and do some film. But typically what happens, a player starts to modify, they start to simplify, they start to improve how they're hitting their ground strokes. Because they hit so many ground strokes, ball comes deeper, faster, higher level frequency, but they don't really improve their volleys. You know, if you hit so many ground strokes and you're staying close to the baseline, you at that elite level, you can't help but improve your groundies. But along the line of smiling, the other day on TV, Andy Roddick and Jim Curry, I could understand where they were kind of lost that because they named somebody who was like Alcaraz, that he's got a smile on his face when he's losing. You know, he's just got that Jim Lehrer sense of enjoyment. But actually, Vijay Armitage, I've coached a lot of Indian kids, and I give them a hard time. They don't even know what Vijay Armitage is. And I go, no, need to go listen to this guy speak online. And granted, they got to tell people, you know, they got to get their schoolwork done. Let me ask you another question. We're trying to go back to some of the things we've covered before with players, weaknesses or strengths. What do you want him to work on? Obviously both, but what's your breakdown and what do you recommend?
Well, I mean, that's a great question. You know, I think in reality, I mean, I don't think there's most of the people that I deal with, I don't even know if their strengths are strengths. And it's just, you know, it's like, Stephen Covey or Covey, however you I call it Covey, but I mean, you begin with the end in mind. I, at least that's what I do. And I always try to think about where it could be, you know, and, you know, kind of like sculpting, I guess. You see a rock and you see the sculpture already in there, and you chip away and you make it happen. And I think that there's a lot of factors that I have to look at. I mean, how long do I have the player? Is there going to be a relationship where it's going beyond a week or things like that? Are they going to be able to follow up if they're an out of town person? But you know, I certainly am a believer that you have to continue to strengthen, but at some point, I mean, you got to address weaknesses and build them. And you just don't want to have holes, and you got to plug the holes. And usually by plugging the holes of the weakness, the strength gets better anyways, because when you plug holes with people, it seems like they get better understanding of what's going on. And, then they can even apply it to the side that may be stronger. You know, it's like, I mean, you used to tell me, you know, I thought I had a good back end, but that's just because I was comparing it to my forehand. And that's how many people, I think, approach their game. They're not really able to look at it objectively. There's just so much emotion involved. So I think that people just need to build every aspect of their game. I mean, they're always looking to get it a little better somewhere, even if it's, you know, something that's already pretty strong. It can be stronger. If it's weak, there's no debate. You just got to plug the hole.
Lots of great answers. Freddie Foreman, he might give you a pat on the back instead of a kick in the fanny. What about serves? First serve, second serve. Thoughts on that? Differentiating? What do you have to do to hit a better second serve? Go ahead.
I mean, you know, we mentioned Mason, who came here and, you know, was actually living in the room that I'm sitting in right now. Now it's my fitness room that's got cobwebs on it, not been used, but Mason sat in here, and I remember the first weekend, and you had already spent time with him and, you know, really got him, you know, on the pathway. But I remember the first weekend they came up to visit from Austin, and I, you know, his serve, I mean, he couldn't really break an egg with it, even though he was in the ballpark technically. And he wasn't a big kid really then. And I just told his dad and Mason before they got back in the car to go to Austin, that was before he was living here. And, I said, just hit two serves, kind of a Maxine Cressy, you know, just hit two serves, just hit them. And he wasn't swinging. And I think that, you know, I think of Sam Querrey, when you talk about the first and second serve and the year Querrey made the run to Wimbledon, Querrey always did big first serves, and he had one of the bigger serves in the men's game. But at that particular Wimbledon where he made his run to the semis, and I think he beat Djokovic, didn't he, in the quarters, he had the smallest gap in miles per hour between his first and second serve that he had ever had in his statistics in his career. And, you know, for some reason, he went after his second serve much, much more in that tournament. I think it was because he was, you know, he was on the grass. He was going forward maybe a little, or looking to go forward off the first ball even more. But it was a marked difference, because prior to that, he had such a huge first serve, but he was known to have such a huge gap between that and his average speed of the second. And I think...
Go ahead.
I think people got to swing loose, and they got to, it's like playing basketball. I mean, when you came out of a basketball game, you know, if I was in a basketball game and I didn't have a few fouls by the end of the game, you know, you got reprimanded because you weren't playing aggressively enough. And, you have to do the same in tennis. I think you got to learn to swing and be willing to take a few double faults here and there. And, you know, the toss variance on an east-west contact point shouldn't be that radical a difference between your first and your second. But again, when you go to most junior tournaments, you know, there's a 2 to 3 foot range, it seems, minimum 3 foot probably, on whether they're hitting a ball on their serve.
I tell people I heard this from Pat Cash. I don't want to get Pat in trouble, but I didn't hear it from Pat Cash. You know, we're going PG-13, but you got to hit the urine out of the ball. I mean, the ball's yellow. You got to go for it. Mason, you know, yeah. When you talk to young kids, and obviously he's a few years older now, but do they really, you know, the jockocracy or what the coach is saying from a technical standpoint, but just in jest, I used to always say to him, Mason, that means you're a builder. You got to build your tennis game. I think it just went in one ear and out the other. I would just say, Mason, you're a builder. With, the nerves. Jim Lehrer used to say that. Number one, you have to have strokes that hold under pressure. And number two, you have to be really physically fit. How do you help kids with nerves? I'll just ask you a couple more questions and we'll call it a session. But how do you help kids with nerves?
Well, I mean, obviously, through the involvement back in the tech program and getting the exposure to Lehrer and, you know, having tried to pick up as much knowledge about, I mean, we had Bob Neff, you know, working here in the early stages of his career, you know, who's a sports psychologist and now tied in with the USTA out in Carson. And so, you know, trying to pick the brains of people like that and study as much as possible. But, you know, I think that in so many cases, you know, nervousness is related to technical flaws or tactical flaws. And, you know, the risk management that a player takes on the court in regard to their tactics doesn't really match their mental DNA and support, you know, being a rock mentally. And I think that technical flaws and, you know, even when it's funny, and I don't know, you probably feel the same way, or maybe you don't, but I, you know, when you've really cleaned a kid up, when you've gotten somebody who had a bad, bad base and they get clean and it's years down the road, it seems like there's still scar tissue, mentally from their past, even though their game's cleaned up, and there's still that mental scar tissue that, kind of lingers. And, trying to get them over that, you know, I think that, you know, hard work is just, it's a necessity, and there's just no way around it. But, you know, oftentimes I think I try to make sure that, like I said, the three-legged stool, the player, the parent, the coach, that the parents are doing all they can to give their kid the freedom to swing and rewarding them for it. And that, you know, it's easy to say and it's hard to do. It's easy to say and hard to do. I mean, it's one thing to say we don't care if they win or lose as long as they play well, but, you know, they really got to compete well, and they got to work on what they're working on towards their long-term goals. So I obviously, having said that, I mean, we try to implement so much of Dr. Lehrer's work, and put that into play. But I think that at the core of it, you know, it's all intertwined. I mean, stroke, strategy, mental and physical.
Yeah. For our listeners, we dedicated, I believe, two podcasts to Jim Lehrer. Then we had Jim on as a guest. He should be inducted in the International Tennis Hall of Fame.
No doubt about it. Traces
of the old. Arthur Ashe said at one point, Jim Lehrer is the most important person in tennis today. And he said that, you know, the wholesomeness and everything went behind it, but also too with parents and, you know, putting winning and losing in perspective. You know, years since that, you know, Lehrer spent time with us in person, I mean, his books are really driven towards character. But traces of the old. Yeah. I'm telling young tennis players more and more, I said, I could be wrong. And I know a lot of young kids, you know, they go through things like where their grandparents pass away, and you never know what someone's been through. But a lot of times a young kid, the toughest thing they are going to encounter is changing their strokes early on. You know, it's not easy. It's actually, to me, it's an adversity. It's a blessing. I'm sorry. It's adversity is a blessing. Adversity is a blessing. But people don't look at it like it's a downright burden. But yeah, scar tissue. I'm always telling people you got good myelin, bad myelin. You don't want to have a bad rep. And so there is no substitute for good beginning. You know, people have to realize that much of the work that I'm doing, you know, I've done in recent times is rehab work. And I know you're doing a boatload of that, but it's you know, with Stuart Van Horn on talking about Welby, when we were in Tyler, Texas, and you know, you think of someone like a Clayton Stanley who ended up playing at the University of Texas. You know, he started in grade school. And you know, the sooner you can start with someone, and then listen to that Welby, you know, we dedicated a podcast to Welby. We're going back, and based on Andres Barbosa, he's telling us we need to reinforce our pillars. That if kids could start early and be consistent and stay with it, because the traces of the old, I mean, the term scar tissue, that's not just technical, it's tactical. And if they don't start early, again, Braden, there's no substitute for a good beginning. But if you don't start early, you just have to have an unbelievable work ethic. But you have to understand the difference. But the brain will, especially under pressures, revert back.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, and in a world where, you know, if a kid goes to conventional school, that's where things like having a home backboard and having routines are just critical.
Yeah.
They have to have those in order to give themselves a fighting chance.
And then use it. Find a backboard, use it. How far is the track? How far is the gym? You don't have a gym at home, you know, by foot, by bike, by car. A lot of kids aren't
I'm looking at my Peloton right now.
Do you know how to?
I don't want to tell you how many times I've been on it.
Do you know how to plug it in?
We don't even have the screen. The screen's there, but it's just blank. We gave up on that. During COVID, we panicked.
I had good intentions to be on a treadmill during the NHL playoffs, but I've been doing emails and text messages during commercials.
Ralph Waldo Emerson, the road to hell is paved with good intention.
Say that again?
Ralph Waldo Emerson, the road to hell is paved with good intention.
That's good. I'm going to go write that on the bathroom wall. Yeah, we need to get together. We're going to get a little better on our podcast. I think we need to get some call-ins or have some people send questions that totally disagree with us. There are people out there that totally disagree with us.
There are?
Yeah.
Dang it.
We have a few comebacks to get into the debate. We're talking about Russian tennis, and we had... Go ahead.
No, that'd be great. I think it'd be good to have feedback going like that from people.
Yeah, for our listeners, when I used to challenge, when I was training tennis coaches formally, they got a college degree, I would challenge them to a debate, and I would take the inefficient way. No, you come over the top of the ball, and this is why. And it's amazing how senior vets that have been BSing for a long time, there's obviously an art to BS, and there's people out there that... Yeah, you don't want to pick on people who are selling used cars, but that person could sell you a car without tires and tell you that you'd save on air. But Natalia Sorokin, she was out at your place after she was with us. She came as a parent first, and then an intern. And she's been around the information. I would say now she give her the title parent coach. Her youngest daughter, or only daughter, Taisia, this is a line that David, I said, well, Carlene Bassett, who was 8 in the world, she was hitting some balls with Taisia. And Taisia, a lot of time on the track, she moves well. And she's been part of the great base for a long, long time. So I told David, Carlene Bassett really likes the way she hits the ball. So I get listeners, maybe you understand, some of you understand this for sure, but David and I were in Boca Raton. We had the opportunity to be running Seguzo Bassett. Now it's Chris Everts. So when I said Carly Bassett, Seguzo Bassett, she really likes how Tasia hits the ball. And David said, well, that's too bad. She could have 30 courts of that right now. But that's, I think that's another podcast we could hypothetically, you know, if the biggest word in the dictionary, if things had gone our way and we were in Boca Raton, you know, what could we have done with the academy? The goal when we went there is we wanted to make the academy honest. We want to make the economy, the academy world honest. And I really think that, you know, a lot of times people would be much better staying at home. And, you know, yeah, as you said a couple of times, the attitude of the household, get the content and go to work as a family, and then find a coach who can really teach fundamentals. There's so many people, that's another thing we can talk about. We got to sign off now, but a pre-academy. You know, mm-hmm. Kids should have to go to a pre-academy. At one time, Roddick's, if the kids weren't really highly ranked, a couple of people I had trained were running. It was the Roddick's had moved on, but they sold the rights to the name. I was out there when the Roddick's owned it and then when they didn't own it, but they had kids come to come work with me for 3 weeks or they wouldn't let them in the academy. But yeah, it'd be great to get back and that would be a fun podcast. What if, you know, yeah. what should really happen? And these Florida academies that are so international and players coming in and, you know, just, you're going to say, well, okay, we think you need to go back to the drawing board and they look at you cross-eyed. But why don't you share something from Fred Foreman, the wit and wisdom of Fred Foreman. I know my autobiography is going to be written on a piece of confetti, but Freddie, volumes.
Well, I like him a lot.
That's all you're going to say. I was going to say, what's, you know, he's taught you, he's influenced you, he's inspired you. Mm-hmm. What would be the one thing that you say
I took Fred under my wing. Oh. I took him under my wing when he was, I don't know, I guess he was a year younger, grade younger, maybe two grade younger. And let him, you know, he ended up hanging, we hung around and my dad was a military. My dad served in Korea. And so he was, I just always remember when Fred would come up and, you know, he had long hair and he reminds me so much of Michael Keaton because Michael Keaton,
especially in that one movie. What's the name of that one movie?
Well, there's
Beetlejuice.
There's Beetlejuice, and then there's another movie that he's even. If you watch it, I think I told you when we were texting one night. Night Shift with Michael Keaton. It was one of his first movies, and it's literally like being in the room with Fred.
I love Freddie Foreman.
My dad used to always tell Freddie, he goes, "You need to join the Marines." You need to join the Marines because he just had so much bottled up energy and he was bouncing off walls all the time. And
didn't your father also say, which was a compliment, he'd make a good Marine?
Yeah, he'd make a good Marine. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, because Fred wouldn't be scared to charge.
Yeah.
He was a little guy back then too. I think he wrestled 98. He may have wrestled 105, but he was quick. He was a pretty good wrestler. I could, you know, I didn't wrestle. I played basketball, but I could have bend him, I'm sure. I was 140 pounds.
Yeah, I think if you can have a coaching staff with an entertainer. Hindsight, yeah. I mean, wishful thinking, tell people to stay away from wishful thinking. But with my two boys playing tennis, Freddie was around when they were really, really young. And he met him many times in Germany, but just because that's our listeners, that's where Freddie's based now. But I would have loved to have him be there every day when my kids were coming up. The few years we were with us, I mean, the juniors, well, they just love that guy.
It's the passion tank. I mean, he's going to put passion in, you know, just because of his energy. And I mean, Connor had that. Your youngest, he was an entertainer, kind of like Freddie.
Yeah.
Connor, I remember driving home with him so many times when he lived here. And Connor, you know, he'd be like, yeah, I'm going to play some college tennis and then play some doubles on the tour and then be a commentator. You know, and he was probably 14 then. You know, he already had the whole pathway dug in. He was a funny kid. He could imitate anybody.
Yeah, voices. Comedy. I'm trying to think of some comedians. Is it Jeff James? What's the name of the Aussie? He gets the funny thing on gun control. Anyway, Can't think of his name right now, but he used to say that Connor, you know, you do him better than he does himself. You just had it down. But
yeah, the voice is down.
I think with Freddie. I mean, it's our listeners should know that trying to arrange a big time exhibition, we might get two or three people to play. First time I ever played an exhibition, the only person left was a golden retriever. We found out quickly that we needed to make the exhibitions one set very short and sweet. Dennis McCreevy could play at Redlands. We were rookies. But Freddie the Entertainer, I always tease Anderson, we're going to have that exhibition. And Freddie's gotten better, and he's not playing the guitar anymore, and he's going to beat you like the bongos, Anderson.
Yeah, I think I have a better chance of growing hair than Freddie does of beating me. I don't see that happening at all, but I'm willing to give it a go. If we do, we're definitely going to put it on a YouTube link and put it on the Great Base so that people can witness the beating.
Bald is beautiful, but Samson, you know, strength is in the hair. Freddie actually doesn't wear his hair down to his shoulders anymore. A little disappointed in that. Hey, I got to shut up. Too much inside chit chat. But Anderson, great to have you on. All the best to you, your family, your students, your staff, and we'll keep marching forward. We'll do it again.
All right. Until next time. Thanks a lot. Yep. Have a good night. Bye.
All right, our listeners, podcast in the books. Pearls of wisdom, golden nuggets in your tennis treasure chest. Over and out. Thank you very much for being part of the Great Base podcast.